Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soci.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soci. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got through another week. Hope you're feeling safe. Hope you're feeling healthy. Hope you're being good to one another, and hope you got to see some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we will get to the grab a pencil portion of the show in a bit. But first, another monumental show here at Film Sociology. I could have him on the phone, but why would I when I can finally get him back in studio? One of the founding members of the Indiana Film Journalists Association, the film man himself, and you can see him in a hair competition with Mackenzie on Indie Style, Chris Lloyd. Hey, bud.
Hey, good to be here. Always love being here with a film lover that I love to talk to.
And I love you, too. So feel the love here at Film Sociology. Okay, we got a lot of territory to cover. A really busy week that doesn't involve G.I. Joe. Did you see Snake Eyes?
I did not. They didn't screen it for critics or anyone. I'm not even sure if people are aware that that's part of the G.I. Joe franchise.
It's trying to look like superhero movie, sort of.
It looks like a movie made for Chinese market, and we'll throw it into some American theaters just because.
There you go. And so we'll get and you can go to the film yet because I believe somebody did a review of it.
We'll be getting one up. Alec Toombs is going to brave the theater and see it, and we will have a review up. By the time you're hearing this, it should be on the site.
Oh, so he was like my old bit of AMC on Friday at 11 a.m. with the old, the unemployed, and the weird. Fun group.
I was going to say, that's my target
that
demo.
That is our target audience. You're listening to Film Sociology here at WFYI. So we'll get into stuff that we talked about. Now, a film I didn't get a chance to see, and you, I believe, did, is the latest from M. Night Shyamalan, who is trying not to be a cinematic punchline nowadays. And it's the film called Old with Gael Garcia Bernal. And it looks like they're not going to wake up in at a Pennsylvania village reenactment of Connor Prairie Place, right?
No.
He says snarkingly.
I was going to say, Gael Garcia and Rufus Sewell, and I'm not sure if there's any other names that people would recognize in it. It's largely kind of an unknown cast, but I think mm-hmm. that's kind of getting back to his roots of he had some big names in his early movies.
He did.
I think he was trying to go for more of like a group ensemble kind of thing.
Right. But this is, I'm going to guess from seeing it, this is, of course, the one where they're on a beach. And Chris will describe it better than I do. But it's, you know, everybody gets older faster on the beach. It's not an allegory about skin cancer or sun or, you know, aloe. M. Night's films tend to be scary with some message inserted, if you can find it.
Yeah, there's some metaphysical thing. There's some sci-fi thriller angle going on, maybe commenting on society. I don't know. But yeah, so people are on a exclusive island, resort getaway, you know, the sort of things that, you know, people who have at least a couple of commas in their net worth, so the sort of vacations they take.
Are these the HDTV people?
Yeah. Not driving to grandmother's house, which is what we do. But they are approached about having a special time on an exclusive beach on the other side of the island that only special people are told about.
Double secret special.
So it's this big, it's this like enclosed beach with these strange looking mountains around it. And they quickly decide that, realize that people are aging very rapidly, but they can't leave. If they try and leave the way they come in, they pass out and have some bad head case happen to them.
I was
going to
say, which red shirt from the Enterprise had to do that first?
Yeah. And they first notice it because they're kids. There's a number of kids who are like between the ages of like 6 and 11 with them. And suddenly the 6-year-old, it looks like she's about 13. And the 13-year-old looks like she's about 18.
That's the point of view of every father.
Yeah. And then, as you might guess, things start to go bad. People start to die. They're looking for ways to escape. The ways to escape lead to more bodies. And eventually the mystery will be revealed. And
is this M. Night's 10 Little Indians?
Oh. Now, see, people are really ragging on this movie. They're calling it laughably bad. And I can tell you at the screening that we saw here, yes, we actually got a live screening in the theater of this in Indianapolis. There was much laughter and not in intended portions.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Uh-oh. And I didn't think it was terrible. The scary parts are definitely scary. They got under my skin. He was trying to keep this PG-13, and I think this was an occasion when he really should have just gone for R.
Ooh.
And really, you know, creeped it out. But there are, yeah, there are some parts that are laughably bad. And it kind of ends with one of those endings where it's like it would have been better to just leave it a mystery, but we've got to absolutely explain every last little thing.
Does Bruce Willis show up at the end?
No.
James McAvoy? No.
No. So, I mean, to me, I gave it 3 out of 5.
Okay.
I think the parts that work. The parts that don't work definitely don't work. But I was actually joined on my television show.
Your television show.
Well, the television show
of which you are on.
The television show on which I make a guest appearance once a week. Joined by Logan Sowash and Andy Carr of the Film Yep. And we actually taped it outside the theater, like literally 3 minutes after we watched the movie. We are now talking about the movie.
Fresh reviews.
Very fresh. Movie criticism in the raw. But they ragged on it much harder than I did. But they actually said it falls into that so bad it's laughably enjoyable kind of category.
Really? So it's more enjoyable than Last Airbender and After Earth?
Yeah, which I've not seen Last Airbender. I've only heard the rumors. But I heard that was just not even laughably bad.
It was bad. It was really bad. So.
But just not to be enjoyed bad. But people are saying this is sort of... like you will still be scared at the parts to be scared, and then you'll laugh at the parts that they didn't mean for you to laugh at, but are still enjoyable.
So a couple beers and a pizza, maybe
yeah.
We'll kind of go with that. So
yeah.
Okay, there you go. So that's old, and or as I believe the AV Club in their headline, "What a drag it is getting old." Thank you, Rolling Stones. Okay. Opening in theaters this weekend that we both saw, not together, but I actually saw this one a while back, is the film Joe Bell with Mark Wahlberg, who I can't remember if he is a producer on this or not.
I think he's a producer on all his films these days.
That makes sense. But yeah, here's I'll let you describe it because Chris is far more eloquent than I am. But I do want to start the review by saying this is a film that I describe, and I thank our dear, dear departed friend Ed Johnsonot for this term. It's basically an R-rated after-school special.
Yeah, that's a good description.
and I believe Ed first used that with Gran Torino. I want to credit him for that. And I've always credited him whenever I've used that term. In fact, sometime on social media, I might have to go, what is your favorite R-rated after-school special?
Yeah,
it's not this.
The way I put it is this movie is, and it's well-acted. I think Mark Wahlberg is solid in it. And the young actor who plays his son, I think, is very good in it.
Yeah, well, and this is every other film.
And so it's based on the true story of a man who is walking across America to bring attention to bullying, specifically of his son who came out, I think, at about age 15 and was mercilessly bullied at his school in Oregon. And so he and the son are walking across America. And so we see them kind of going along and doing the bonding, but also not really getting along thing. The idea is that Joe Bell is very much like a blue-collar, working-class...
Mark Wahlberg.
Drinking beer, watching football. Really, yeah. I mean, it's sort of trying to emulate his star persona of a blue-collar, tough guy is the dad who can't really relate to his, like, artistic, gay son.
Right. And there's a great scene. And there are some
good moments in this film. I'm not totally ragging on it. But, like, the moment when his son comes out to him, it's an inconvenience for dad because there's a ball game going on.
Yeah, yeah. Which was they try and tell him, like, right before the football game is about to start, and he's totally, you know, on a that's what he's thinking about. And so when he says he's gay, he's just got this look of not even so much shock. It's just like, why am I talking to you instead of watching the game kind of thing?
Yeah.
Reed Miller plays the son, Jane Bell, and he's terrific.
The scenes they have together are pretty good. And
yeah.
And there's the father, the Wahlberg character, becomes understanding, but he's conflicted early on where
right.
he doesn't want – his son wants to be on the high school cheerleading squad and be the only male in the cheerleading squad. But why does he have to practice out in the front yard? Can't he go to the backyard or the closet to practice?
Yeah, exactly. He's very much in adaptive behavior mode, which is to say he's out of his comfort zone. He's trying to do the right thing. But, you know, it's so alien to him that, you know, we understand that, like, this is just the start of a journey that they're going on together, figuratively and literally.
Yep.
And, you know, he is not going to be the dad who suddenly is, you know, testifying before Congress about how
the big Oscar speech.
Yeah. So I will say, you know, things go on in the movie, and then there's also, as they go, flashbacks to during the time, the months before the trip when the kid was first coming out. There's a reveal in the middle of the movie that I won't tell you anything about.
Same here.
Which I thought was well done and well placed.
I agree.
For maximum.
There's a moment where you think we're being vague now. You think that a character is denying something because he's ashamed, and we realize, oh no, this is a storytelling device, and that works. And as soon as that works, this film can't end fast enough.
Yeah. The screenwriters, the same screenwriters that wrote Brokeback Mountain and won an Oscar for it. So top line screenwriters. I thought the problem with this film is like you said, is being an after school special. It's a movie that has its heart in the right place. Wants you to know that it has its heart in the right place and wants to be rewarded for having its heart in the right place rather than just organically telling a story. And the way I put it in review is, you know, I'm trying to be forthright and talk about this from a cultural standpoint, but I don't think the movie would have been made without Mark Wahlberg in it or someone very much like
right.
him, because with his star persona as sort of, you know, blue-collar guy, you know, let's face it, I don't know about Mark Wahlberg as a person. I'm just going by his star persona. He is more likely to have been the kid bullying a gay kid in school than being his friend or helping and being supportive.
Or you can look up Mark Wahlberg's past online.
Yeah, and it's not pretty.
And there's
always.
Unfortunately, and this happens, friends. I'm sorry. This was in my head the entire time, and I couldn't shake it. I couldn't get it out. If this is a rehabilitation
right.
for him. Okay. The other thing I heard was this film, I think it premiered at Sundance last year or the year before, and they had cut it. I mean, it was apparently like over 2 hours, and they edited it down considerably, which I'm kind of thankful for because of the critique I just gave.
It's about 95 minutes, I think.
Thank goodness. But yeah, that I couldn't shake the – and trust me, I can separate the artist from the art guy, but that's all I could think of as I was watching this picture.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's well-intentioned. I do think Mark Wahlberg – and I'm the guy – I mean, 25 years ago, I mean, I made fun of Mark Wahlberg's acting.
We all did.
Because
who
it
knew?
It needed to be made fun of. And I think he really has, you know,
improved.
Put in the work.
Yeah.
I think he's become a serious actor, you know, when he's not doing his bro dude comedies, which he seems like he has to reel one of those out about every 5 years.
Well, you got burgers to support, so.
Yeah, exactly. But Reed Miller, that's my takeaway from this movie. Reed Miller, terrific stand up and take notice performance by a young actor. Hopefully we'll be seeing more from him.
There you go. Also opening this weekend is Broken Diamonds. And as a sibling, I'm always intrigued by films about older siblings that are dealing with each other because there is a chemistry and a conflict that happened at the same time quite a bit.
Yeah.
And this is Ben Platt for you fans of musical theater and Lola Kirk for you fans of Gone Girl and Mistress America, among others. But it's I will give this film credit of it gets things moving fast. Within less than 4 minutes, we know he's a writer that's going to quit his waiting job, and he's going to go to Paris to write a novel. dad dies, mom is nowhere to be found, sister's in a hospital facility, mental health facility, and things are just not going to plan. And then it starts to turn into the Skeleton Twins, but not as funny.
Yeah. And I think, I'm trying to remember in the movie, but we see the name of the facility, and it's actually like, you know, whatever, like, you know, Trade Winds or whatever it is.
Right. Make it sound like a subdivision.
But it actually is like Trade Winds Mental Health Facility or something like that. And as someone who works for a company that actually has mental health facilities, I can tell you that we don't use that verbiage in the names.
So she gets kicked out for being difficult and has to live with brother in the house that they inherit. And she can't move into the new place in 2 weeks, which is the same time that he is supposed to go off to Paris.
Right.
And we're selling a car, and we're trying to be good to one another, brother-sister things happen.
And it's got all these built-in deadlines and conflicts that, you know, it's like, okay, it's like literally within, as you say, the first 4 minutes, the movie has set up all of its hurdles for them to run down the track. Same thing, you know, well-intentioned movie, liked Ben Platt. I'm a big Lola Kirk fan. She's an actress that has been in small films. You probably don't know her name. Go rent Mistress America now that Greta Gerwig is a big
Mistress
force.
America, yeah.
Great movie that not too many people saw, and she was great in it. I liked what they were doing, but you know, everything is done from the perspective of the brother character. So even when she's having her episodes and hearing the voices and things like that, we don't experience it as she does. She doesn't have agency. She doesn't have ownership of her life and her mental health struggles. It's all, how does it affect the brother?
Yep.
And I was just kind of turned off by that. I mean, it's one of those movies that, I don't think was trying to set out to be insensitive, but it ends up coming across as Adventures with My Crazy Sister.
Yeah, or a sibling movie.
Yeah.
As I was going through my notes, if you've seen it, and when I say films about siblings, my favorites include You Can Count on Me, Georgia. I mentioned the Skeleton Twins, which feels like it's a more dramatic version of this. They are not singing to Starship in this one. But, seeing somebody from your past, and then you go to a social setting, and the sister makes a spectacle of herself in said social setting.
As we know she must.
As we know she must, yeah. The Job Hunt, you could also call it independent picture. As you said, it sets up all these scenarios that we've seen a lot. And the acting helps overcome the kind of by-the-numbers aspect of the script. I think, as I wrote in my notes, twinkling guitar and cello, indie music, as far as your soundtrack. So, and guess what? Between the siblings, there will be a breakdown.
Yeah.
And then there will be a resurrection of sorts. So I say, yeah, if you like the actors, you'll forgive them a little more, I think, than the script itself.
Yeah, that's out on VOD, video on demand. So feel free to check that out in the comfort of your home. Really like the actors. Really wish they could have been given some better things to do.
And that being said, I think we got one more new picture, which is the best picture of this week, the documentary Val.
Yeah.
Val Kilmer's kaleidoscope to himself. And it's not what you think.
Yeah, I believe it's on Amazon Prime. Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah. So, very interesting thing. It's a biopic documentary of Val Kilmer, really by Val Kilmer. Although a couple of other guys are listed as director,
but he's given cinematographer credit because of his lifetime of recording everything.
Literally back, you know, from when he was a kid in like the 1970s, his brothers and they were making home movies, recreating movies that they saw. They were like the first kids to get a video recorder or camera.
Yep.
When those came out. And apparently, you know, like as each new generation of, you know, home video recording technology came out, he was like the first one to buy it. And he's been shooting stuff from the sets of his movies at his homes with his kids, just goofing around his whole life. And this is thousands upon thousands of hours of these videotapes. And so this is basically the distillation of that into a 108-hour movie. It's really intimate. It's at times painful to watch. The reason he's making it now is pretty apparent. If you didn't know, he kind of seemed to disappear about 3 or 4 years ago. It's because he had throat cancer.
And the radiation basically took his voice.
Yeah, and he wears a, I don't know if it's called a tracheotomy tube or something related to that around his neck. And so in order to speak, he has to cover that hole with his finger and talks. And if you've ever, usually people you've encountered who have that voice usually have like the little vibrating device that they hold up to their neck in the old days. But, you know, it's very robotic and gravelly sounding. The way I put it was, do you remember Roz from Monsters, Inc., the gravelly?
Yes.
All right. Imagine if she's talking to you over a walkie-talkie underwater.
At a drive-thru.
Yeah, that's what he sounds like. So, I mean, there's no way he can play a character who isn't someone who has his condition, which not many people do. So, I mean, he's making this now because, you know, he says in the movie, I mean, I know my ability to be an actor and do lots of kind of different roles is done. But he still comes across as this sort of very creative soul who generally just lives to create a bit of a ham, you know, as he says.
And he's the first to die.
Yeah. And, you know, apparently he's been that way his whole life. And so here's a look at the guy. But, you know, everything, you know, what happened on his movie sets, it's clear like movies were like Tombstone or The Doors, where he was just absolutely dialed into a role and just absolutely nailed it and created those iconic parts. And frankly, when he was checked out and didn't care, like he talks about Batman Returns, and he was like, I hated it. I hated being in the costume. I felt like a overpaid mannequin.
Yeah, there's and his art, which you see throughout the film, painting, and he does kind of collages, and that's kind of this film as a whole is this great video collage of everything. So everybody, I think, if you're a film goer, you have your point of view of Val Kilmer, and that eventually will show up in this.
Yeah,
because we saw, you know, as I was writing down in my notes, character actor stuck in a kind of young leading man's body, and the deal, his deal with fame early on. And we also see where he was for a while, of course, deemed difficult to work with. And I think we actually see the moment where it happened because he filmed it.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a second. But, you know, there's some really cool early footage. Like, I didn't realize his high school sweetheart was Mare Winningham. And then he was he was the youngest or one of the youngest people that was admitted into Juilliard. He helped develop a playwriting course there, had a show of his produced. And it was supposed to be a lead in the New York show, and this is 1983, and then got pushed back to second lead because they got Kevin Bacon, and then got pushed back to third lead because they got Sean Penn. So there's some footage of that. Yeah, there's behind-the-scenes footage of Top Gun, and then the between Top Secret and this, no real genius footage. That kind of bugs me because that's actually the first thing I noticed him in and really liked him in. And then from Top Gun on. And but yeah, seeing that rise and him dealing with the fame and meeting his future wife, now ex-wife. I mean, you got all of the home footage of that, his relationship with his parents, which is very touching and difficult.
Death of his brother at a young age.
Yeah, and that really, so I'll sidetrack on this. It's easy to make fun of a performance artist Joaquin Phoenix, but he had a similar tragedy in his family at a very early age, and I think sometimes we forget that. And I didn't know this with Kilmer's character, or with Kilmer the man. I didn't know that his brother died at that young of age.
When he's about to go off to, he was literally like getting ready to go off to Juilliard when his young brother drowned, but he still ended up going, but it obviously deeply affected him his whole life. I think that's what those home movies with his brothers, I think that's what compelled him to keep shooting his own video all through the rest of his life. But yeah, a lot of interesting things, you know, like he lost his fortune twice. Like, he lost all of his money, his Top Gun money.
And because, helped his dad, tried to help his dad with some real estate deals.
Right. As he puts it in the film, I had a choice, sue my own father or write a check for everything that I had. And I said, I wrote the check.
Yep.
And then, you know, what happened to him a few years ago is he owned a big ranch in New Mexico. And, you know, obviously money not coming in the way it was, and he wanted to start an artist commune there, and it was, well, do that or sell the ranch, and he had to sell the ranch. One of my biggest reveals was the island of Dr. Moreau. He was so excited to finally work with his icon, Marlon Brando, who barely showed up. And I mean that literally, in that we find out that many of the shots that you see, what you think is Brando in that movie, are actually a stand-in named Norm.
In whiteface.
Yeah.
And there is a documentary about the making of Island of Dr. Moreau, which I still need to check out. But yeah, that thing
is. Did it include that anecdote about Norm?
I don't know. I haven't seen it. But it is a cluster F experience between the original director dropping out, and then they bring in John Frankenheimer, a more than capable director, who didn't want to hear Brando's suggestions, and then gets into a fight with Kilmer, which is in the film.
Yeah.
So if you're in the gossipy, juicy Hollywood tidbits, this is the tastiest
of
them all.
So Frankenheimer obviously does not come across looking great in the movie, but on the other hand,
he's like, making the island of Dr. Moreau.
The movie was weeks behind schedule, millions of dollars in the red, and it was literally like he comes in and cracks the whip and finishes the movie, or the movie doesn't happen.
Yep.
So it was sort of like, you know, let's put it this way. If Frankenheimer hadn't come in and done what he'd done, we wouldn't have all this lore about the film now.
And I think this is where it began, of the reputation of being difficult because of Kilmer's commitment to his craft.
Yeah. He is a little bit reticent about it in two areas that I noticed in the documentary, where he doesn't really give you lots of details. It's about his disease. Like, he doesn't actually say, I had throat cancer. He just talks about being unhealthy. And in fact, in real life, when he was first revealed that he had throat cancer, he actually denied it to the press. And then a few months later, he had to say, okay, yeah, I had throat cancer. So the movie doesn't really touches on the physical and spiritual impacts of the disease, but doesn't really go deep into it. And also his divorce. He talks a lot about their marriage and early life and all that, and just basically has like one line where he says, we were both on the road working so much.
He got served papers on the Moreau set. And there is one where he's, the other thing I didn't realize, so I guess we owe a slight apology to Sean Young, but he would make audition tapes and send them to filmmakers.
Yeah, which I thought was great.
And it didn't work with Full Metal Jacket. It didn't work with Goodfellas, but it did work for him to get Jim Morrison in the Doors.
Yeah, so.
And there's footage of him practicing Doors songs while his wife, and as he even says, Joanne was in agony because that's all I was doing for months and months and months.
Yeah, I think there's a line another actor has about him, which says, like, you know, what did you think about Val Kilmer? He said, I think it was for the Doors. They said, I don't know. I've never met Val Kilmer, but I've met Jim Morrison.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is that aspect. Yeah. And he talks about, you mentioned playing Batman, and the fact that, and George Clooney has also backed this up, that you can't move in the thing.
And also, one of my favorite things in the film was,
His
relationship with his children, as I said, his primary romance these days is obviously his being a dad. That's what gives him love in life. But, it, you know, since he can't work to make money, he goes around and does appearances, introduces showings of Top Gun
and
at
Tombstone,
a drive-in and Tombstone, and does the thing where he signs, you know, at Comic Cons, where you sign him autographs for money, which I've always wanted to say to, like, a faded star or someone like, how do you really feel about having to do that, having to go around and get paid to sign your name or take pictures? And here's somebody to tell us honestly and I think authentically how he really feels about it.
And it's funny because I had this discussion on Drinks with Dee Dee, the podcast. We did this earlier this week. But from a fan standpoint, what I appreciate about, and I know certain actors, whether the roles dried up or not, that can go from convention to convention and get paid. So there's that aspect of it. I don't know what the percentages are, and, you know, I'm not going to get into numbers, but also the fact that you get immediate direct contact with the fan base, or vice versa, and you get a few moments, you get to tell this person how much it meant, and you're kind of supporting the artist, just like buying. This is an old term. If you go see a band play and you buy a CD off the bandstand, off the stage, and the money goes directly to the musicians, not the agent, not the publicist. Now a convention gets a cut of it, but But you get where I'm saying on that. And so, yeah, the fact that he's now – he was on the convention circuit for a while, and they show it's a grind as well. I mean, he does it until he is tired and has to rest and then comes right back.
And until the line ends. That was the saddest part was, like, you know, they're having a barker going around saying, we've got Val Kilmer giving out autographs and – there's, you know, I mean, he had a big line, but then he got through it, and what's that like? And we find out.
Exactly. There's a moment where, and one I didn't think I would see, but a kind of a reunion with his ex-wife and the kids because his mother dies, and him breaking down when he gets his mother's jewelry. I mean, he's a complicated human being, just like we're all complicated human beings in some aspects, and I think kudos to him for opening himself up as much as he does.
Yeah. Like I said, I think there's
a couple of areas
where he is reticent. I think the way I put it was, I think he decided, or I'm guessing, but I think what he decided was there's so much to say on that topic that it's best to say little.
Yep. So, yeah, that's probably the best film that's opening this week is
I would say,
Val.
I think I saw five new movies this week. Of them, that would be the best.
There you go. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. There's one title I want to get to that I forgot to mention that's on a film movement called Rose Plays Julie. And it's the story of an Irish girl who's in med school in Dublin, and she goes to look for her biological mother, and then she finds the mother, who's a known actress, and finds out more about her past and the father, and what first turns into kind of adopted movie, and I know I'm using name of title movie because we've seen a lot of these stories before, where, you know, the confrontation between mom and dad and daughter and what happened, and then it kind of turns into Carey Mulligan's last film as far as how the dad was a terrible human being and what happened in order to. And it's one of those I don't want to reveal a whole lot, but if you're into adoption dramas and revenge movies, you could do a lot worse. So Rose Plays Julie is out on Film Movement. So how are things happening at the Yap?
Thefilmyap.com.
You have big news. I know it's still new news, but I wanted to make sure that the folks, you have an opportunity if you enjoy the Film Yap.
Yeah, that's right. If you can believe it, thefilmyap.com has been around for 12 years, making us, believe it or not, one of the oldest film websites out there. And we still have thefilmyap.com, but we are transitioning to a new platform. You've probably seen a lot of writers transitioning to the direct reader engagement model. We're using Substack. There's other ones. A fellow friend of ours in the arts and entertainment area, David Lindquist, has also moved to this area with his newsletter. But it kind of combines, instead of just saying the old idea of a website.
Right.
Let's take some new things and some old things and combine those together. So with Substack and other things like this, it kind of is harkening back to the old pamphleteer tradition, going back to, you know, the 1700s.
Book learner.
The idea is subscribe to our Substack, and you get our stuff, what we publish, new reviews, in your email inbox. Literally the second I hit publish, you've got it. So you don't have to even work. You can read it on your phone. You can do anything. Or you can go to filmyap.substack.com at any time and just see what's being offered there, the latest reviews in just a very straight feed format, top to bottom. Here's the newest, here's the oldest, or you can search for older stuff. I've been thinking about it for about the last year or so. We finally kind of started trying it out about 4 months ago. And really, I guess I've kind of put both feet in just within the last couple of weeks or so. So it is free. You can sign up for free, and we have all of our free content that comes straight to you, to your email, or just going, like I said, to filmyap.substack.com. Or if you're willing, maybe, like to support us, like to support local film criticism.
It sounds like NPR now.
Yes, you can throw us a few bucks.
Yep.
We have what we call the premium level. It's very cheap. It starts out cheap, and I even put a discount on there so you can start out. I think it's for $3.50 a month, or you can sign up for a whole year for $21, and you get all of our premium content, which means to say you get access to everything that we do. We've also got some ideas we're cooking up about giveaways and exclusive engagements with our critics. So I know it seems like nowadays a lot of people are moving to this model, so you got a lot of people asking you, can you please roll a few coins in my bucket?
Yeah.
So I'm here to do just that.
Shaking the coffee cup.
Yeah, just because here's the thing. I've been rethinking the idea of the magazine-style website that it seems like every film site has.
Yeah.
Where you go in there and here's this, here's our podcast. It's a model that everyone's been doing for a long, long time, and the idea that you can make money from it, we've tried it every which way from Sunday that you can. I mean, the way the website advertising world is set up is just like everything else. All the money goes to the big dogs, and the little guy gets nothing. Yep. Or just a few scraps. The idea is you have to have monster traffic going to your website in order to get advertised to advertise on it. And we get a good amount of traffic on our website, but not enough to consistently get advertising. And with a direct reader engagement, what it is it's literally saying, hey, you care about movies, we care about movies, let's have a conversation together. Rather than trying to get 300,000 people to come to the FilmYap website every month, let's do it with a much smaller number, but it's more intimate. And yes, we'll ask you if you're willing to support us with a few dollars, just like everything else. You know, if you love reading newspapers, if you love reading magazines, just like anything else, give a few dollars to support it. Otherwise, we can't do it. And it's the same thing: is please give us a few dollars. We're going to keep doing it until the end of time. But, you know, nobody's looking to get rich from this. My
says the NPR millionaire over here. I know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My goal, honestly, is I'm not even so much care about making money for myself. Is I want to pay my contributors. I want to give them a few bucks every month to say, hey, thanks for your time and your effort and your creativity. Because it actually does take all that stuff to produce good quality film criticism and commentary and podcasts and all that stuff. So, yeah, please sign up, filmyap.substack.com. Sign up for free. Try it out. I'm content to stay free forever if you'd like. But if you are willing to give us just a few filthy lucre, we will gladly take it and be grateful.
You sound like Don's Guns.
Yeah.
I don't want to make money, folks. I just like to talk about films.
Yeah. And some people ask me about, like, why are you doing this? You know, so far we're keeping the old website, but what we're doing is we're just putting, like, short nugget-sized versions of the reviews and saying, click here to read the rest on Substack. So I don't know if the old website is going to keep hanging around forever. Or go away or whatever. I'm still trying to decide about that stuff. It kind of depends on how people react to this new platform.
So long as the Matthew Soucy wing in the decrepit archives is way over there. Okay, that being said, we go to one of my favorite sections of the FilmYap. Reeling backward, I will ask you, Chris, when did you actually watch Last Train from Gun Hill?
That was actually pretty recent.
Okay, all right.
Because I am, at this point, I've been working about 3 months ahead on the Reeling Backward column. But what I'll do is if I get a Blu-ray or DVD that's just being released and I want to be timely with it, is I will reshuffle things around.
Yeah.
So I actually just watched that maybe like about 4 weeks ago. Kind of a forgotten Western with Kirk Douglas and Anthony Quinn that's now out on Blu-ray. Very, very handsome restoration. They were the colors as vibrant, the images as crisp as the day it hit the screen. So very, not a great movie, but I think a good one.
Wasn't this John Sturges's director? Wasn't this the film he did before Magnificent Seven?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I think it was 59.
Yeah.
Definitely one worth checking out. But yeah, so when I end up reshuffling movies, saying like, oh, okay, this one that was going to publish next week, I'm going to slip in this Western there. I think, Some Kind of Wonderful is the loser. I think I actually saw that like 6 months ago.
Oh, the Chris Columbus, the John Hughes.
And I kept moving it back and moving it back. So I think it's finally going to publish next week.
Okay, all right. Did you do The Gray Fox?
No, I would love to do The Gray Fox. Another one of those great, nice little Westerns that at this point now are probably a little forgotten.
Well, we'll have to work on that. Okay. Yeah. Look at not looking and you know, humming and hawing negotiations here at Film Sociology. So, yeah, look out at the FilmYap for all your goodness there. Before we get to the grab-a-pencil portion of the show, Chris, we're going to go to the drive-in. And, of course, you know, as I've said many times before on the program, I love bizarre pairings at drive-ins because it more than likely is the studio or somebody thought one for him, one for her, or one for the kids and one for the grown-ups because they hope the kids are asleep. Not like the old days where, you know, and they have to be recent, apparently, although we'll get to the skyline in a minute. But, you know, it was great to see when we were younger that, you know, if Arthur was the main film, the secondary one would be 10. Now, granted, it's Warner Brothers and Dudley Moore, but it was also a two-year-old picture. That rarely happens nowadays.
Yeah.
So, we at the Tibbs Drive-In on screen one, Snake Eyes and Space Jam, A New Legacy.
I haven't seen Snake Eyes. I have seen Space Jam.
There you go. Screen two, Escape Room 2, or I'm sorry, Escape Room Tournament of Champions, and Pig.
That'd be an interesting one.
That's what they did there. Screen three, Old and the Forever Purge. The one in the daytime, friends. Oh, that's it. They're both scary and they're in the daytime.
Yeah. The pairing with Pig seems off because I think everyone expected Pig to be the latest
bat poop crazy.
Nick Cage does bat poop crazy stuff. And from what I've heard, I've not seen it. It is not that.
And then screen four is just Black Widow. All Black Widow, all the time.
So, I liked Black Widow.
I do too. I like the family stuff more than the CG fighting. It almost felt like an independent film version of The Incredibles.
Yeah. I mean, it was like they finally gave a female character the spotlight, and I think Scarlett Johansson did a great job really exploring the character. The action-y stuff was a little just because you had an independent film director who'd never done big CGI stuff before, and I don't think they quite knew how to stage it right. But also, we don't have any gods with celestial weapons, no sorcerers, no hulking green mutants.
You don't need to consult the chart, Marvel chart.
There's only one character who has quote-unquote superpowers, and even that doesn't really get like a big, you know, blammo moment.
Yeah, and Rachel Weisz and Florence Pugh gets Marvel money, so kudos to them.
Kudos to them.
Okay, over at the Skyline Drive-In on Wednesday, July 28th, they are showing Spookies and Sorority Babes in the Slime Bowl Bowl-a-rama.
Wow.
Yeah, those are drive-in titles, friends. And then July 30th, next weekend, Jungle Cruise and Black Widow.
My kids are looking forward to Jungle Cruise.
Are they?
I'll put it that way.
Okay.
It's one of those movies that you just like Space Jam. It's like if you're a parent, you just have to endure.
You're going.
My kids gave Space Jam 10 out of 10 and a billion out of 10, respectively. So that tells you where it is.
Okay. Over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, depending on when you're listening to this program, of course, but on July 24th. At 2 and 7:30 p.m. on the big screen, Ma and Pa Kettle Back on the Farm. Hmm. Have you ever seen a Ma and Pa Kettle film?
I don't know if I have.
I don't know. Bob Bloom has. Bob, if you're listening, please fill us in on Ma and Pa Kettle films. He's probably been given the box set. He probably has the Ma and Pa collection. It's not on Criterion, but it's out there. Coming soon, Sunday, July 25th at 2 p.m., it's a members only if you're of Franklin Heritage Incorporated, but they're showing Forrest Gump. Tuesday, July 27th at 10 a.m., Daffy Duck's movie Fantastic Island.
Hmm.
I don't know if I know this. It's from 1994. Don't tell anybody. But in the artwork that goes with it, Speedy Gonzalez is there. Don't say anything. It's fine. And then just saying. Friday and Saturday, July 30th and 31st at 2 and 7:30 p.m. from 1996, Twister.
Oh, yeah. I will defend that movie.
Will you? A disaster movie meets Cannonball Run?
Yeah. Hey, without that movie, Philip Seymour Hoffman doesn't have a career. Isn't he in that?
Yeah, he's in that.
Yeah,
he would have a career. He did Scent of a Woman before this.
He was climbing the ladder.
Are you saying Twister led to Boogie Nights?
Well, let's put it this way.
He'd already gotten punched in the face by Paul Newman in Nobody's Fool.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to look this up. All right, here we go, friends. Hot clicking here at Film Sociology.
Hot clicks.
Oh, yeah. I can't type worth squat. Okay, let's go through Mr. Hoffman's IMDb page. Unfortunately, it won't take that long. Let's see. All right. All right. He'd already done an episode of Law & Order and a film called Triple Bogey and a Par 5 Hole. Good Lord. My New Gun, 1992. Zooler from 1992. I forgot he was in Leap of Faith. The Steve Martin as Elmer Gantry kind of film from 92. Scent of a Woman, Joey Breaker, my Boyfriend's Back, oof. Money for Nothing, the remake of The Getaway.
Oh, wow.
Man. Okay, The Yearling, When a Man Loves a Woman, or Nobody's Fool. Heart 8. Yeah, he was in Heart 8. Then Twister, then Boogie Nights. All right, so maybe it was that led to Boogie Nights. Maybe.
Yeah. Have I ever told you my Law & Order story?
What is your Law & Order story?
It's more of an anecdote.
Oh, please, anecdote away.
I'm at NYU watching. I'm in the student room with one other person watching the episode of Law & Order. The guy the other guy turns to me and says, "You know, I'm in this." And I'm like, "What?" And in fact, as I'm looking at him in the dark, there's a young guy playing a college student accused of rape in the episode, and it's him. He was like a drama department guy, and he was in Law & Order, and he was there watching his
himself.
Own episode with me.
I've never done that with Die Hard 2, I swear. Yeah. That's like Bob. Remember, if you remember the opening scene in Autofocus where Greg Kinnear is playing Bob Crane and he's at a bar and there's a woman he finds attractive at the end of the bar and he tells the guy, because he knows when every rerun of Hogan's Heroes is on, turn on channel 4 or whatever, and she turns, sees him, sees the TV, goes back to him, goes and walks up to him and says, "Aren't you Bob Crane?" And then he filmed it.
Yeah. There. It's not as good as my Shaquille O'Neal anecdote, but there it is.
Oh, come on. What's a Shaquille O'Neal?
No, I'm saving that one.
Oh, see, you have to become a member and, you know, subscribe, and you get the Shaquille O'Neal anecdote. Jeez. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, so here comes, friends, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, I'm excited for this, friends. So as you know, since COVID, we get to the grab a pencil portion of the show where I will read on Facebook and Twitter what you have been watching, and maybe that will inspire another listener or reader or watcher or even us. It's been, especially when we had no new movies going on, it was kind of reassuring to know that we were all watching stuff and we're all recommending things for one another. And since Chris is in studio, and I'm thankful for that, we might comment a little more on what you've been watching this week. So we'll see. But there have been moments where somebody will mention a film, and I'm like, oh, that's at the top of my pile. I should actually watch that.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But we start on Twitter with Andy, who writes Karate Kid 2. That's a lot of Peter Cetera clench jaw singing there with that. So, and I think that might be it. Okay. Well, just checking on that. So we go to Facebook and we start with Craig, who writes Secrets and Lies from Mike Lee.
Oh.
And as I wrote, that's a lot of Brenda Blethyn crying.
Yeah. I remember I liked that movie and I hated that they used the title. Like there's a character that actually says Secrets and Lies. And I hated that
just
moment.
Just like that.
Yeah.
And as Craig also chimes in, I have to admit I'm not familiar with Brenda Blethyn, but I've seen crying. I've never seen crying as hard as she does. Mike Lee's films are not to everyone's taste, certainly not mainstream U.S., but I like his portrayals of very ordinary, very flawed, sad, damaged people, even if the results are a bit depressing. Craig, you're kind of dead on with that. I've been a fan of his work since Life is Sweet, and he's right. And also the commitment. If I remember right, he will workshop with actors for months,
wow.
6 months, 8 months, and then out of that kind of comes the script and the story. So there's a commitment. He's got kind of a regular, like Timothy Spall is one of his kind of regular go-to players. So really fascinating performances from the actors in those films, even if, as he says, they're not always the most cheerful. It was the first time I noticed, it was a Mike Lee film, that I noticed David Thewis in the film Naked, which is a great performance, and I've not watched it since.
Yeah.
And that's 1994. That's a really, really hard one. But I do love films like Topsy-Turvy is probably one of his easier going ones, Happy Go Lucky, Mr. Turner, Vera Drake, for you fans of Imelda Staunton. You got a favorite Mike Leigh picture over there?
Secrets and Lies is up there. And again, I probably haven't seen it in so long. Naked was really good. That's him, isn't it?
Yeah, that's him.
By the way, do you want to hear my David Thewlis anecdote?
Oh, you're not saving it for the subscription. Yes, of course I want to hear it.
It's not very exciting. I met him here in
Indy. You're going to tell us anyway.
And interviewed him at, I think, the Carmichael? What's that old, very swanky but in a subdued way hotel
the
down
Canterbury?
There? Yeah, the Canterbury.
Yeah.
Interviewed him there for Striped Pajamas.
Oh, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. Yeah, the Heartland film.
He's very tall.
Really?
You wouldn't think from his movies, but he's very, very tall.
Cool. I like him. There was, and he was also in Island of Dr. Moreau with Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando that we alluded to earlier.
Yep.
And the grasshopper in, I think it was like my daughter's introduction to him in James and the Giant Peach. He is also one of those actors. Because, and I cite Wonder Woman as an example. You cannot cast him because you know he's going to turn on you.
Yeah,
it's the Liev Schreiber syndrome.
Yeah.
Don't do that. So, okay, moving on. Taylor writes, To Live and Die in L.A., The Last of Sheila, and The Birdcage. And I need to watch The Last of Sheila again. That's, I think, was it Sondheim who did the screenplay on that with Anthony Perkins? Mm. Maya writes, Mother's Day. David writes, Inside, Bo Burnham. Talladega Nights, The Big Lebowski, Ash vs. Evil Dead Season 1, Luca, and Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made.
Oh, yeah. That's an interesting one.
That's streaming, I'm guessing.
Probably.
Okay. Rick writes Summer of Soul and Frances Ha, another Noah Baumbach film with Greta Gerwig and stuff there.
I mean, it's her first screenwriting credit.
I believe so. That's right. Kevin writes The United States vs. Billie Holiday and Summer of Soul. Mary writes The Other and The Fourth Kind. Devin writes Space Jam, Space Jam A New Legacy, and Pretty Woman. I always wonder if it's that in that order.
I was going to say, that would be an interesting triple feature.
There you go. Joshua writes Fear Street Part 3. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed the series. The Banker and Summer of Soul. Now, of course, you can read the review of Summer of Soul in the film, yeah?
Yes, authored by a wonderful local critic.
Thank you. Have you watched it since it's been published?
Have I seen the film?
No, I'm sorry. Or are you working on other stuff?
No, I mean, you know, I'm like a shark when it comes to movies. If I miss a movie when it's coming out, I'm already on to next week's movies, unfortunately.
That's the plight of us, folks. First world problems, and we know. Our buddy Lou Harry writes an old twist, The Tammy Show. And Lou, I actually found a DVD copy of The Tammy Show earlier this year and really enjoyed that. So glad you got to check that out. Badlands, early Terrence Malick. Early Terrence Malick, before my Terrence Malick rule, where his films should be no longer than 70 minutes.
Oh, boy.
They look great, and they could tell just as quiet and vague a story in 70 minutes than it could in 2 hours and 10.
Yeah, boy, do I run hot and cold on him.
Yep, that's what keeps it going. Daydream Believers, The Monkey Story, and Gunpowder Milkshake for you butt-kicking female fans out there. Kim writes The Food Club and Lawn Dogs. Kim writes on the big screen. Yeah, apparently somebody, one of the theater chains, did a 70th anniversary screening of The African Queen.
Yeah, I think I heard about that. That's cool.
Nice. Joe writes The Long Riders from 1980, featuring film sociology guest James Keach.
Cool.
Nice. So here's my anecdote, and it's not in a subscription, so I'm going to tell you. When James was doing the Glenn Campbell documentary, I'll Be Me, he came to Indianapolis to talk to Lilly for funding.
Hmm.
And I remember, I can't remember how I got onto it that he was coming to town, but I got a hot tip from a snitch. I'm sorry, a reliable source. And it was, the deal was I could interview him, but I had to pick him up from the hotel, from the very nice monolith looking hotel near a certain ballpark. And it was January in the dead of winter.
And
it was just nasty cold. And he came in. Brought him over here. I had like an hour with him by the time I had to pick him up, do the interview, and bring him back. And we talked about you know, we talked a little bit about the documentary, and then he let me geek out about the Long Riders, which is always good. Really cool Western with all of the Keaches, all of the Carradines, all of the Quaids, yes. all of the guests, directed by Walter Hill and music by Ry Cooder.
Total unicorn movie, never made before, never will be made again.
Exactly. So, Joe, yeah, you watched The Long Riders. Thank you for that. Midnight Run from 1988, of course. That was one of those films. I remember the summer of 1988 because it was the summer I graduated high school. And that film and A Fish Called Wanda, I saw more than all the other summer films combined because it was those films. And I'm sure I'm going to ask you, Chris, if you have that. When you were younger, you went, what? You haven't seen this? And you grab the person and go, let's go.
Yeah.
Do you have your versions of those films?
Yeah. It's always astonishing to me, though, when you come across people who haven't seen, like, E.T. the Extraterrestrial or The Lord of the Rings or Star Wars. I'm trying to remember who was the person I saw on Facebook. It was a good friend of my wife's who said they'd never seen a Star Wars movie. And it's like, I mean, how is that physically possible? It's like almost impossible to navigate the world without, you know, accidentally falling into a Star Wars movie theater.
It happens, I guess.
I'm actually often the person, though, particularly like in the 80s or 90s when I was in college. There were certain movies that came out that I you know, like a lot of musicals and things like that. What's the Kevin Bacon dancing movie?
Oh, Footloose.
Footloose. I'd never seen Footloose.
I like it as Kevin Bacon dancing movie.
And what's the Patrick Swayze dancing
Dirty
movie?
Dirty Dancing.
Dirty Dancing. So I've been slowly catching those with the Reeling Backward column and writing about them.
Well, and yeah, I'm with you on that. I remember when I had my intern, McKenna, she had given me, when she graduated and got a job, she gave me kind of this really lovely gift basket with movies that inspired her. And one of them was Labyrinth. As I mentioned on the show before, we went up to Dearborn, Michigan, where at the Henry Ford Museum, they have a great exhibit of Jim Henson. And so all, you know, a number of Muppets of note on display. And you have one of the characters, the old fat female monster looking thing from The Dark Crystal, and the white gown and the tux from Labyrinth, wow, which launched 1,000 whatevers for a lot of people. But yeah, I was 16, I think, or 17,
right,
when that film. And I dug David Bowie, and, you know, I liked looking at Jennifer Connelly, but I wasn't seeing that. I was too busy. I was in guy action movie land because I was a teenage boy in the 80s.
Exactly. And I finally caught up with that one and really kind of loved it.
That's a reeling backwards, isn't it?
That is indeed.
There you go. See that? Okay, back to Joe's list. The Patriot from 2000 and Liberty, the American Revolution PBS from 1997. Oh, Chris writes, old Joe Bell, Broken Diamonds, Val, and Star Wars The Last Jedi.
Yeah, that one was kind of a half watch. That was I was doing arts and crafts with the boys, and we kind of just had that on in the background. But we would stop and watch it for 10 minutes and then kind of go back.
How are the boys on Star Wars?
Oh, yeah.
They're in?
They love their Star Wars. I do think they like the original trilogy and the prequels more than the last grouping.
Way to go, Dad. Way to go. So when do you start to show them The Hidden Fortress and Silent Running Dark Star?
We shall see. They hit their Minecraft phase about four or 5 months ago, so their movie we're watching is actually down a little bit.
Tell them to look up. Every now and then, eyes up here, pal. If you could tell, that was Chris's contribution. Bonnie writes, thank your lucky stars, Black Widow, Luca, Onward, John Wick 1 through 3.
Way to go,
Bonnie. Yeah, I know Bonnie. She would. And Gunpowder Milkshake.
Wow, that's a good – did she – see the John Wick movies in preparation for Gunpowder Milkshake?
I don't know. Well, actually, Bonnie's just a butt kicker in her own right. So probably, you know, it might have been that. So friends, we're assuming that you're watching these in the order that you're writing them. So we hope so, because it's fun that way. Dylan writes, a Polish vampire in Burbank, Nudist Colony of the Dead, oh, we're in a certain genre here, and Street Trash, some of the most fun I've had doing research yet. Thank you.
All right, I want to meet this guy.
Good. let's see. I think I can, yeah, I'm going to tell this. Back when the show was live, and I can mention this, she's a good sport, Chris Kirshner, who when at the time she was on was on Channel 13, and in the Dead People We Like portion, thank you for that, Chris, Marilyn Chambers had died, and she says to me, "Please don't ask me about her." And I said, "Why, are you a fan?" She goes, "No, because of her work." And I said, "I won't." So it was just a bad day for her to die the week that a news lady was on. But anyway, yeah, let's I might have to look up those titles, but not here at work. Ron writes Gunpowder Milkshake as well.
A lot of people seeing that.
I know. It's starting to pop up. Melissa writes Old and Black Widow. Wayne writes Let Him Go and Black Widow. Last week's guest, Greg Sorvig, was on the show, of course. And, okay, either he saw Top Gun or he's using the Tom Cruise gif, him saying it's classified. So he's either watched Top Gun or he's being a wise apple.
I bet you he's probably seen Top Gun.
He's being a wise apple. You know, I think he's done
Heartland
both.
Those people are pretty connected.
They are very connected there. Dustin writes The Little Foxes from 1941, the TV movie Temple Grandin, The Irishman, Chernobyl, and Judas and the Black Messiah. Good list this week, Dustin. Well, he has a good list every week. Eric Barker writes his first views, Let Him Go and The Hunt. Your rewatches are The Furies, Thedora Goes Wild, Body Heat, Bullet, Red Desert, and Get Shorty.
Was The Hunt was the movie from last year that got released right before COVID? That one?
Yes, the Hillary Swank, the liberals that was, hunting.
That was the last movie I saw before COVID hit.
How'd you like it?
It's interesting. It's not great, but it goes in different directions from what you would expect. It was not the movie that it was hyped to be either, depending on whether you were inclined to lined up to be hated or lined up to love it. It was not that movie. I'm blanking on the main actress's name.
Hilary Swank.
No, the main actress is Betty Gilpin. I can't remember. I'm blanking on her name.
That's all right.
But she did a very
Betty Gilpin. You're right.
Gilpin did a completely different take than you've ever seen on sort of the horror scream queen kind of role.
Okay.
Very, very different, very sardonic, and I really liked her in that.
Oh, that's right. Glow. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, Glow.
Very cool. Yes, we enjoy that. That was the last film?
That was my last one until Tenet in August, and boy, was that a letdown.
Man.
After all that wait.
How many people were at the screening of Tenet?
So it was at the Indie IMAX Theater downtown, and they did have it spread out pretty well. So it was at most probably like a quarter of the seats were filled.
Okay.
Maybe not even that.
And then after Tenet, what was the next one for you?
What was it? Would have been this year.
Would it, In the Heights? Or Cruella? So I'm trying to think. Because In the Heights was the first one for me.
Yeah, it was something that they screened for us.
Okay.
I can't remember.
That's okay. That's right. The last film before COVID was Bad Boys for Life. And so I was really...
Boy.
Yeah. So I was really happy I got to correct it with Within the Heights.
What was wrong with Martin Lawrence's face in that movie?
I don't know.
We're like with Ashley Judd, we're not supposed to talk about their faces apparently, but what was wrong with his
I
face
don't know,
in that movie?
But he had to do that apparently. You know, the smart aleck remark for me is who asked for this other than Martin Lawrence and Will Smith? So yeah, there's that. All right, thank you, Eric. Teresa writes Life of the Party and Crazy Rich Asians. Our very own Bob Bloom chimes in with Old and Val, in that order. Daniel writes Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid, Gerontophilia, hope I'm saying that right, and Up the Sandbox. Bill writes a rewatch for me first. Oh, wait, what? A rewatch for me, comma, first time view for my leading lady. Oh, his leading lady. Okay.
Oh.
Lady Hawk.
Oh, see, I love that movie.
See, I thought he was, because I often refer to Michelle Pfeiffer as my leading lady. Mrs. Soucy is making fun of me now.
I did a reeling backward column on that, I think, last year.
You did.
And you can find it on fillmeup.substack.com. I do have all 12 years archive I managed to port over there. So check that out. I love that movie for a lot of reasons. I love the electronica soundtrack.
Was it? Did Vangelis do that, or was that another one?
That was Tangerine Dream.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, Rutger Hauer, Matthew Broderick,
yep, and Michelle Pfeiffer. And I need to revisit that again because I still use the Lady Hawk reference for my fandom for the Detroit Lions, because every other Detroit sports team has won a championship in my lifetime, and I think I'm just going to wander the earth like Lady Hawk until the Lions win one, which means it ain't happening. And I know everyone's been on kind of a Richard Donner kick with his passing, so that's a pretty good choice.
Yeah.
So anyway, checking out Bill's contribution. Part of our ongoing salute to Richard Donner, revisiting his work that one or the other of us have somehow never seen. The Goonies will be up next. Same setup. We both enjoyed it and tried not to be too distracted by the amusingly relentless 1985 sounding musical score attached to a fantasy period piece. The electronic score is a dividing factor. I think it's the coconut licorice of film scores.
Yeah.
There's no, you either love it or you hate it.
I love the electronic. There was a very brief era there of like late 70s to mid 80s where we had those movie soundtracks like that, and they kind of went away. And boy, I would love for someone to bring it. Although,
Drive.
Yeah, Drive. We've seen a few things come back with that.
Mrs. Soce refers to it as the fame music.
Yeah. We showed the boys the Goonies about 9 months ago. Because we had, since we were kids, there was so much swearing in that we'd forgotten.
Was it a PG or PG-13?
I think it was PG-13.
So there you go.
And we'd forgotten there was that many bad words in it.
That was another one. I was 15 and I kind of tuned out. So I've not watched it probably from start to finish since. So
yeah,
I have to work on that.
Same thing with Stand By Me. We showed them Stand By Me. And we remembered that was rated R. But still,
is it? Okay,
there's some F words and
That's fine. Is it? Because I also deemed that film as a teenager too whiny. Is it not that bad, or was I just
insecure? No, I think it stands up really well.
Okay,
I think it stands up really well. And the boys, actually, I was surprised. I thought for my, he was still 7. He just turned 8. I thought he might have been a little too young for it, but they dug it.
Caught into it. Okay. All right. Back to the list here. Sean writes The Men, also known as Marlon Brando's film debut. That's right. Lila writes A Quiet Place and Black Widow. Abby writes Vertigo, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Precious, and Mayor of Easttown, the series.
Wow. That's a nice list.
That is a good list. Rachel writes Ghost on the Loose, The Legend of Hay, McClintock, The Mummy, and Crocodile Dundee 2. Not one, not in Los Angeles, two. The Legend of Hay, H-E-I, was particularly good. The time period was not what I expected, but it worked and brought back pleasant memories. Thank you, Rachel. Gary writes Sleeping Beauty from 1959, Mary Poppins, Black Widow, Console Wars, Les Mis from 2020. I'm assuming that's a National Theater Live or live performance. Finding Nemo, The Changeling from 1980, George C. Scott, Canadian thriller from, was it Pete Medak, I believe. Bruce's Deadly Fingers, that's a Bruce Lee knockoff, I believe. Frida and Alien.
That's all in 1 week?
We're stuck inside, man. I mean, we got things to do. No. Doug Long. Doug says, still doing research on musicals and films from 1962, but other titles, The Girl of the Golden West from 1938, I Married an Angel from 1942, African Queen, Verdiana from 1961, Let's Make Love from 1962, also from 62, My Life to Live, and 1985's Clue.
Wow.
Was that also reeling back? Backwards?
Not Clue, no.
Okay, all right, sorry. Deb writes Pig. Mario writes Trainspotting, T2, Dog Day Afternoon, and Manhunter. You got your 80s slick Michael Mann stuff there.
Yeah.
Frank writes, I actually rewatched Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death. I think Frank's with our earlier person who posted. I'm like, can't look at that at work. Britt writes Tangled, The Hunt, Gunpowder Milkshake, My Dinner with Andre. That's the double feature. That's iRobot and Space Jam, A New Legacy. Britt, lie to us and tell us you watched those back-to-back. You watched Gunpowder Milkshake, and then you cleansed your palate with My Dinner with Andre. You have your My Dinner with Andre lunchbox or action figures for you fans of Waiting for Guffman. That's great. I wish that was true. So Kathleen writes Red Joan and the Friend. Jose writes Roadrunner. Yeah, the Anthony, did you see the Bourdain documentary?
Wonderful. Probably the best documentary I've seen this year.
We saw it last Friday. Really, really liked it. Really hit home for all three of us. And it's the same filmmaker that gave us 20 Feet from Stardom.
Right.
And now I'm blanking on it.
But a noted documentarian.
Thank you. Thank you. That really helps. No, it's going to bother me now.
Yeah, but it affected me in a lot of the same ways as the documentary Amy about Amy Winehouse. It was like a vaguely famous person that I wasn't really that familiar with, didn't really watch these shows. And so there was a sort of a chance to sort of become acquainted with him and regret my ignorance of what he was doing while he was alive.
Oh, yeah. Won't you be my neighbor? That's it. Jeez, no. Sorry, Morgan Neville. And, yeah, Best of Enemies, which I had just watched and bought earlier this year. Jennifer Wright, Chef. I can't get enough of that warm and fuzzy ending. I agree. I also, yes, and one of the greatest grilled cheese segments in film ever.
I have daydreams about that grilled cheese sandwich that he's making in the movie.
Stay over there while you're doing that. Yeah, I'm with you on that. In fact, film sociology guest Simon Majumdar, in his Eat My Globe podcast, he will be doing the history of food in art, television, and cinema. So I'm hoping Chef will be brought up. And of course, I love it because you know a guy wrote it because John Favreau, your ex-wife is played by Sofia Vergara and your current girlfriend is played by Scarlett Johansson. You thought I wrote this. Michael writes Lawrence of Arabia, The Keeping Room, and A Face in the Crowd.
Wow.
Still relevant today. Just as relevant today as it was in the 50s. Still Andy Griffith's greatest contribution to show business. Come at me, Mayberry. I don't care. Carrie writes Tomorrow War, Black Widow, and Old School. Lisa writes Outside In, nice camera work. Gretchen writes still exciting to be making my way through Gilmore Girls, Jane the Virgin, and Call the Midwife. There you go. Austin, for you fans of Medium Cool podcast, Showgirls, Basic Instinct, Phantasm, Total Recall, Deep Cover, and Playtime 1967.
Wow.
And and Deep Cover just got a Criterion treatment. And by the way, there's a certain bookstore that people like, and they have a 50% off Criterion sale going on right now.
Cool.
Till the end of the month. Let's see. I got Town Bloody Hall, the D.A. Pennebaker documentary, Four Feminists Debating with Norman Mailer. Mm-hmm. When We Were Kings. So, yeah, Norman Mailer double feature. But I did not get the film where Rip Torn hits him in the head with a hammer.
Oh, God.
And then Lone Wolf and Cub, the Lone Wolf Cub series for you fans of Shogun Assassin. Michael writes Gilda, you know, the film where she does that bleep with her hair. Thank you. Robert Muggy, who's been on the show. Casque d'Or from Jacques Becker. Clash by Night from Fritz Lang. The Long Goodbye by Robert Altman. Everyone's favorite John Williams score that plays everywhere in every style. Let's see. Greaser's Palace, Sky Point to Robert Downey Sr. And repeat viewings of Easy Living and Murder at the Vanities. Thank you, Robert. Rick writes Casablanca, Quantum of Solace, Lars and the Real Girl, and Tomorrow War.
Wow.
That's a good list.
That's an eclectic mix.
I like that. Sun writes Yes, I Remember. Cassandra writes, had to do some research for the horror film I was in last week, watched A Quiet Place and The Conjuring. So congratulations on being in a horror film. Andrea writes Black Widow, Good Will Hunting, and Midsummer, although she misspelled it. So I think she's talking about the Swedish cult film, not Shakespeare's Play in the Park, which is happening with Indie Shakes this weekend and next weekend. How's that for community calendar work?
Oh, God, I hated Midsummer.
Did you hate Midsummer?
I was like, it was one of those that seemed like everyone else in my social circle really loved it. And I hated it with a
very
burning passion.
A very intense film about getting dumped by your boyfriend.
Yeah. I got into a big argument with a fellow critic in our circle about that. I said that the female character played by Florence Pugh was unattractive, and that she was made to feel unattractive by her abusive boyfriend. And I thought that I was saying that Florence was unattractive. I was like, no, the character feels that about herself. It's quite clear that she feels that about herself.
Until she got the veil of flowers on her head.
Right, so, right.
If you're going to Sweden, put flowers in your hair. So, did you like Hereditary?
No.
No? Okay.
That was another one that everyone but me loved.
We all have those friends, and someday we'll make a film festival out of them. The screw you, I like this film series.
Yeah, well, usually I'm the other one. I'm the guy saying, no, I actually like the one that everyone else considers to be a complete ball of trash.
That's usually my cult film, my midnight film choices, but that's another.
Still, I think one of three critics that gave Catwoman a positive review.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the last time you watched Catwoman?
Not since then.
don't need to.
Don't need
care.
To go back.
The art change we do, but sometimes you just leave it be. So, all right, back to the list here, and thanks for hanging out, man. We got a long list. This is
pleasure.
Fun. Good. John writes, Red Joan with Judi Dench. He deemed it very good.
Oh yeah, not too many people saw that one. It was
that was the is she spy. Or is she not a spy? Yeah.
Yeah, it was well done. I mean, not great, but well done.
Okay. Jesse writes, Magic Adventures in Babysitting. The 1935 A Midsummer Night's Dream. Ooh.
Is that Magic with Anthony Hopkins?
I think that's what it is.
Wow.
That's also a Reeling Backwards.
That also is.
Aha! Huh? See, I knew that.
It was the one William Goldman film that I had not seen.
Oh, okay. And really, really fun acting from Burgess Meredith. And Hopkins was kind of a mess, and Anne Margaret never is. Yeah. So, Midsummer Night's Dream, that's the one with Mickey Rooney is irritating as Puck. But you get James Cagney doing Shakespeare as Bottom. That's pretty cool. I'm assuming the original Get Carter and Pulp, speaking of Mickey Rooney with Michael Caine from 1972. Steph writes Mothra. There you go. This is my old boss, Bob Vavra. I rewatched Smokey and the Bandit the other night. It holds up nicely as 90 minutes of popcorn.
Yeah.
And some days, that's all you need. Diana writes, people scrolling for something cute and light, a Netflix series, Penguin Town, fits the bill. It doesn't directly address habitat loss or climate change, but fun/cuteness factor is high. That, so, like the Disney nature film documentaries in the last few years.
Yeah.
So, and that's it. There we go. So, there's a lot of titles and a lot of opinions out there. So, check that out.
People are watching a lot of stuff.
And, when it comes to, so I guess let me check in with you. So how many films have you seen since going back?
In theaters?
Yeah.
So I guess about 6 or 8 now. If we include Tenet, then it'll probably be closer to 10.
Except nobody counts Tenet. Except for Christopher Nolan.
Yeah. Oh, God. Gosh.
So, okay. So let's, because I've done, let's see, In the Heights.
I actually took my boys to see Space Jam on the day it opened.
Okay.
That was their first time back since,
cool.
Probably.
What was the last thing the kids saw?
Oh, gosh. Not too much comes out for kids in February, March.
That's kind of true.
So it was probably might have even been late 2019 for them.
Oof. Yeah. So, In the Heights, I went to Fast 9 because we got that screening. Roadrunner, and I think there was one other. But yeah, so anyway, slowly getting back into it. That's not too bad. In the film app, I'm glad you wrote about this, but it was about the weekend, the box office results for Black Widow.
Oh yeah, I saw some articles that popped up earlier this week, where people are already declaring Black Widow a bomb and it's tanking and blah 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 because it made $80 million its first weekend. Which was, by the way, the best opening of any movie in theaters this year.
More than Fury, Fast 9?
F9 made 70. Black Widow made 80. But then it had a drop-off of about 67% in its second weekend. But, of course, it was the second weekend. It was going up against Space Jam. Not really surprising. So I just kind of gave the counter-argument to that, which is F9 also experienced a drop about that in its second week, and I don't remember everyone going plots about that. But the girl superhero movie, everyone's got to come out of the rafters. But the thing is, Disney also is releasing it on their Disney Plus platform with the upcharge, the plus money, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And according to them, made another $125 million off of that its opening weekend. So, as I said, Hollywood, who accountants are famous for their bean counting tricks to hide big losses or hide big profits, I don't think they're going through their calisthenics right now with that movie.
Will this eventually eliminate the Monday news feature of saying what's the top ones? Because we can't tell as far as streaming. We don't know unless you're an insider.
Well, it's like Netflix doesn't put out their numbers.
Right.
And I think Disney's put out their numbers just because they wanted to brag on it a little bit. So it's going to be what they tell us.
So maybe that section of morning news can finally go away.
Yeah. Like somewhere deep in a vault hidden many miles underground is the number of how many people who actually started watching The Irishman, finished it, went all the way to the end and finished it.
I own The Irishman.
The actual percentage.
I own The Irishman.
It's a single digit, I think.
No, it's not. First off, I was at a press screening with you and a few others, smart guy.
We had to.
We did. And I.
But on the streaming service, how many people started The Irishman
know.
and then of those, how many finished it? I'm giving it about 6%.
All right, friends, if you're listening to this podcast, when I ask for the movies on Thursday morning, tell me, I might put that as a bonus question, is how many of you have finished The Irishman?
Painting houses.
Yes, so we'll see.
Let's put it this way. If you don't know what that phrase means and you claim to have seen The Irishman, we know the truth.
All right, smart guy. Good. I like that. All right. So I guess, so yeah, Black Widow's not tanking, but if you turn the corner, it'll get the number one draft pick when you pick the correct card. How's that for you sports fans out there? So, once again, go to thefilmyap.org.
Well, thefilmyap.com is the old site. We're transitioning kind of away from that. Filmyap.substack.com. It's just one more word, filmyap.substack.com. That's kind of, we're trying to make that our primary platform. So you can just go there. You don't have to sign up for anything if you don't want, and just read what we're writing for free. Or, as I said, sign up to get it in your email, or throw us rattle some coins in our pocket. We would appreciate it.
Throw a little money in the hat. So.
Yeah, just so I can give all these guys, all these young people on the rise, to give them some encouragement and remuneration for what they do.
What he said. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. I hope you get to enjoy some films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Chris Lloyd, it's so good to have you back in the studio. Thank you, my friend.
Old times. Let's do it again.
Oh, definitely very soon. Very soon. That's a Bill Cosby, Sidney Poitier title. So there you go. That's your pledge dollars at work. Take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!